Blog Talk Radio.
Graham Hancock. You're listening to Earth Ancients with Cliff Dunning.
And happy Saturday to you. I hope you're doing well. You know, it's Christmas time, isn't it? So my girlfriend reminded me the other day, it's time to, you know, if you haven't done it yet, you got to hang your lights, you got to put the tree up, you got to start thinking about gift giving. So for me, it's less about that. It's more about the winter time. The days are shorter. The weather's colder. We're here in California, in Northern California area. And, we had some rain recently. Boy, was that fun. And some thunder and some lightning. And found out we had like a few feet of snow in the mountains, which means that we're slowly going to fill our reservoirs, we hope, with some water. So I think I've mentioned it many, many times. We have a drought. We have a serious 4-year and counting drought, and bits and pieces of rain help create water, and we need to fill that. So the El Nino effect is taking place, and personally hoping for many, many days of rain. So hope you're doing well wherever you're located and you're kind of thinking about Christmas, whatever that means to you. I recently posted a interesting photo of a forensic study. It's on the Facebook Earth Ancients page. And these scientists basically put together what they thought the true Jesus of Nazarene was, what he looked like. And if you look at this photo, he looks like nothing that you can imagine. The blonde, tall Christ that we all, Jesus of Nazareth that we all think of as this individual and that we've been raised with. This person, and I was reading a little bit about this analysis, the typical male during that time in Jerusalem was about 5'1", stocky, dark-haired, not very attractive person. and I posted it not to upset anyone, but I thought it was a very interesting point of conversation. And a lot of people wrote back and said, well, this is not my idea of who he was, so on and so forth. And that's fine. But it's interesting to note what they, based on the skeletal remains of graveyards they've found in that area that have been dated to the time when the person known as Jesus of Nazarene lived, and what the analysis shows is this type of person, this type of body type. And so based on, I guess, many skeletal reviews and forensic evidence, this is what they came up with, this individual. And you can see this person, again, it's on Facebook, Earth Ancients. Go to the group page, and it's a long article with the analysis of what the typical individual was in that time period. So check that out. The other thing I want to remind people is I continually post images and content from dynastic Egypt or the remains of dynastic Egypt. And a couple of weeks ago, someone sent me an amazing photograph of a pink granite doorway, which was cut out of stone. And Egyptologists tell us that the dynastic or pre-dynastic Egyptians used chisels, copper chisels, and stone to cut stone squares, for the pyramid, cut for their buildings and things like that. And when you see this pink granite doorway, and by the way, it was found on an island just off of Egypt. I think I'm trying to think of the city. It's either Memphis or some other place close by. The island is called Elephantine Island. When you see this piece, it is so well constructed and with such a level of precision. There's just no way there's anything that to do with copper tools. It's machined. And it's actually, you can see this doorway. It must weigh a couple of tons. It's huge. In fact, one of the photographs shows two men sitting inside of it because it's laying on its side. This doorway is laying on its side. But the roof is cut with a level of precision that today we can appreciate, meaning that there were some forms of tools that were powered that were able to cut this very, very hard pink granite. And you can see it on the Facebook page, Earth Ancients Facebook. Go to groups, and it's really, really an amazing piece of work, and it really puts into question our understanding of ancient cultures. Whatever tools were used to cut this doorway, we have no evidence of. The evidence, which is presented in books by people like Chris Dunn, is in the final piece, the piece that's left, the stoneworks that are left to us. And this doorway is a marvel. And I can see why it's not in any Egyptologist book or travel to Egypt books or anything like that, because it is an anomaly. It is such an anomaly that it just throws into question our understanding of ancient history. I mean, there must have been a power source that powered tools that were spun at a high rate, or they had laser cutting tools or something that were able to cut this doorway, because it's huge and it's solid pink granite. It's beautiful. Anyhow, take a look at it and see what you think. It's a mind blower. It really is. You know, during the holidays, I like to, you know, get out and walk a little bit. And in Northern California, we are really blessed with a lot of really, really cool places that are considered sacred. And sacred places in Northern California, I'll name a few. You might know Mount Tamalpais, which is known as Mount Tam. I like to go up and hike up there. I'm on the east side of the Bay Area, and there's Mount Diablo. But if you go further north, there's a very, very sacred place called Mount Shasta. And Mount Shasta has been known for a long time. There's some evidence of an ancient native culture around the base of Mount Shasta. It's sacred for more than just being high energy, great place to do healing work. In fact, there's a lot of people that do seminars up there. And on the esoteric side, there's very high vibrations. Some people claim there's Bigfoot up there. There's, there's some books that talk about that it's a doorway to Lemuria. Lemurians were there. There's flying saucers that are seen up there. But understanding sacred sites is really something that I've always been interested about. And every place, it's almost like every state in the United States, Canada, I know in Central America, there's tons of sacred places because the Maya and the Aztec had areas that were considered sacred, and they would build pyramids around them or complexes and things like that. But we don't really know the sacred places that are in California, that are in other parts of the country, unless we, we've got our guest here, just left us. Hi, Brad.
Yes.
There he is. Okay. I was just introducing you. I lost you.
Yeah, you were talking about the pink granite door. That was really interesting, and then the line cut.
Yeah. But anyhow, my guest today is Brad Olson. Brad is an award-winning travel writer. He's a publisher and a producer. And a few years ago, he gained notoriety with his book that we're going to talk about today, Sacred Places in North America, 108 Destinations, which he won the Bay Area Travel Writers Top Prize. I was just mentioning to our audience, Brad, that California has quite a few secret locations, but this book is interesting. What was the drive to create a book on sacred sites around North America?
Yeah. Hi, Cliff. Great to be on your show and talk about this. It started with another book called Sacred Places Around the World. And I began my career as a travel writer, had done a few other books on travel, and was looking for a series. So I did the first book on Sacred Places Around the World. It did so well, it went into a second edition. And then I thought, wow, I've traveled around North America quite a bit and wouldn't mind doing a few more road trips. And indeed, I traveled cross-country 4 times in service of writing this book. And picked up 108 destinations, hence the title, and found that North America is equally as rich in sacred places, artifacts, mysterious sites as South America is, or Europe is, or any other place in Asia or Africa. So I put this book together, and it did very well. In fact, the copy that you have is the second edition, in which I was able to update some of the sites and get some more photos in there and add some more information. And this is the one of the 4 books on the Sacred Places 108 Destination series that sold the most and garnered the most comments and questions from readers. Because the nice thing about Sacred Places North America is when you get it, no matter where you live in North America, in the USA or Canada, there's going to be a place nearby you. And a lot of times while I was researching this book, I'd come into a small town and ask directions or try to get some more information. And a lot of people would say, oh, yeah, I've heard about that place, but I've never been out there. So I'll go out there, and oftentimes I would, and then sometimes we'd come back to the same place and talk to the waitress, say, oh, yeah, I went there. It was great, and you should go check it out. This is like your heritage, and it's right here in your backyard. So that's the joy of exploring Sacred Places in North America, is there's so many places that are nearby where just about everybody lives in this continent.
So here's the information. Here's what I want to find out from you as the author and the traveler. What was the criteria for including this series of 108 locations in your book? Was it because not only was it a sacred site, but there was a special energetic sacredness about it, meditative quality, or what was it that made your 108 top sites for the book?
That's a great question. And the criteria is basically, these are places that are uplifting to people. There are some other books that also chronicle sacred sites, and they will sometimes put in battlefield sites or one place does Holocaust sites. I don't subscribe to that notion. Those are places of deep suffering and human anguish, where I prefer to focus on those places that are uplifting to humans and were recognized by native people for various reasons. About half of the sites in sacred places in North America are Native American sites, and the reasons that those are included are pretty obvious. But the ones that aren't have to do with either pilgrimage sites, and a lot of people don't know that there's a major pilgrimage site in Quebec, Canada, or more contemporary ones that include certain icons in North American history. One, for example, is Graceland in Tennessee, and I did get a very scathing critical review on Amazon for including Graceland, but I'll tell you, when I went there, I saw people crying in front of Elvis's grave. I saw people very moved, and I myself came away with a much deeper appreciation for Elvis the humanitarian, and not many people know that side of him. So as much as it sounds kind of like a corny inclusion, I stand behind that, and I do feel that if people do go visit Graceland, they too will come away with a deeper appreciation for the man.
So there's something about his dwelling and the man himself, Elvis Presley, that is kind of special, is what you're saying, this the energetics of what he left behind, did you say?
That's right. I hadn't realized he was very generous. He would give his money away to charities and also to people who would contact him and say they had some kind of hardship, and if he felt that person had a genuine story, he'd just cut him a check. He was a very wealthy man. And the interesting thing about Graceland, though, compared to rock stars today and famous people and the mansions that they live in, Graceland's somewhat of a humble home. I mean, it is a mansion. It is big. It's on a big piece of land, but it's not the mega mansion you'd expect. Mm-hmm. And then they incorporated the property across the way from Graceland to house his planes, his cars, and all the other museum-type artifacts there. So if you're ever in Memphis, Tennessee, I would recommend checking it out.
That's interesting. I never thought about that. Let's go through a few places and touch upon some highlighted sites that you feature in the book. In Arizona, you mentioned that there are large and small ball courts on some of these native sites. I didn't know that. Can you give us an example of a well-known ball court and what's unique about it? I mean, they've reconstructed a lot of these places, but I didn't know they had ball courts.
Yeah, they sure did, and it shows that there had been a very rich interaction with the cultures of Central America. In fact, I don't think there was really any distinction to the people of ancient Mesoamerica and that there was a dividing line of the Rio Grande River. And the evidence is the ball courts. It was this game called Puck to Puck, where it's similar to soccer. You can't use your arms or hands, but the ball was made of tar and heavier. And the objective was to kick it through a ring that was usually a little bit higher than a person. So it was very challenging to do, but the stakes were extremely high. In many Mesoamerican cultures, the team would be executed. So you'd want to win that game, or at least come to a draw. Mm-hmm. So you asked about where they were in Arizona, and there's a really great one in a location called Wupatki, and it's up in northern Arizona. It's one of the best preserved ball courts that remains, as well as the ruins of Wupatki. It's near the Hopi Reservation on the Navajo land, and about 40, 50 miles due northeast of Sedona, Arizona. So it's very accessible if you're in the Flagstaff area to go there. And the Wupatki Ball Court has been reconstructed, but reconstructed with the material on site. So it was very well preserved, and it is one of the best preserved in North America that you could see. And they also found quite a few artifacts there, suggesting a robust trade with the Mesoamerican cultures to the south, including parrot feathers, which have come from Costa Rica and the tropical countries, and seashells from the Gulf of Mexico. So the picture that emerges is peoples that were on the move, people that were traveling and trading, and the notion of cultural diffusion was well established in the Southwest. Even the most stodgy academic historian would have to admit that finding these artifacts in a place like Wipotki would prove that the people were much more interactive than it was originally thought of. And then this leads to the question of the mound sites in the South and the Midwest, because the first thing that struck me when I went to visit many of these places is how similar in layout and design they were to the Mayan sacred places of Central America, with a central courtyard, with a central pyramid, and flanking pyramids on either side. Of course, the big difference in North America is they didn't have readily available stones to quarry, so they're made out of earth and mud. But that doesn't detract from the fact that the design is nearly a dead ringer to those in Central America.
That's fascinating. Now, they didn't happen to find graveyards of bodies that were the ball court losers, did they?
Not that I know of. And it may be that the bloodthirsty Aztecs made that rule more of a final solution to those teams that had their heads severed. It could be that up in the north it wasn't quite that way, that maybe it was more for sport.
Yeah, that's pretty gruesome. You mentioned Canyon de Chelly in a national monument as a national monument. Can you tell us a little bit about that and why you have it in the book? It's kind of an interesting place.
Yeah, it's pronounced Canyon de Chelly, and it's basically a beautiful long serpentine canyon that extends from the border of New Mexico well into Arizona. What makes it so interesting and why it's a sacred place is people aren't allowed in there. Only Navajo nationals are allowed to go into Canyon de Chelly, except for one location. It's called the White House, and it was an adobe structure that's down in the Canyon de Chelly floor, and they still offer tours there to anyone willing to pay. It's a bit of a hefty price. You can drive to the rim of Canyon de Chelly and look down into it, and it's just a verdant green valley down in the creek bed area, surrounded by very stark red rock cliff walls. So Native American people would often find their spiritual selves if they were on a vision quest, or they would locate areas of rock. And this is very similar with Aboriginal cultures around the world. The Australian Aboriginals come to mind with the Ayers Rock, or they call it Uluru, that they would see different spirit entities in the rock. And indeed, you can sometimes make out the faces or animal shapes. These were very significant to the Native American people, and Canyon de Chelly is no exception. There are quite a few examples that are outlined in the booklets you can read about it. Again, you can't go in there to explore it. And I really respect that and appreciate it, and I hope your listeners will too, not to offer a challenge to go down there and sneak into it, but to respect the Navajo people. And this is one of the last ones that remain. Many of the sacred places I outline in the book had been this way, that they were only allowed to be visited during a Native American vision quest. But nowadays, many of them are tourist sites. So this is one of the few that has remained in Native American hands and is preserved as a sacred place only to those Native people themselves.
That's interesting. You mentioned vortices, and you have you talk about Sedona vortices. What are they, and why are they important? And can we kind of, as we go through talk about those in different parts of the country. Tell us first about the Sedona mortises and why they're important.
Sure. Well, this is one of the locations in North America where earth energy is said to emanate straight out from the rocks. And I've been to Sedona on many occasions and visited these vortex sites time and time again. I outlined four of them in the book, the four main ones that people can go to and go right to the exact spot where this earth energy emanates. And I'll be honest with you, Cliff, I've not felt anything personally, but it's interesting. I've gone there with women, and they've all said they felt it. So it could be that women are more sensitive to this kind of earth energy. And basically what it is it's a feeling of, good tidings, shall we say. It just, I guess if you're meditating, it helps enhance the meditation. If you're already looking around the beautiful Sedona landscape and feeling inspired, it just brings you up a little higher. Other people say that it affects their body physically, that they can feel a tingling sensation or some kind of whirling energy is how it's described in many of the books. Of course, it's invisible. You can't see it. But the women that I've been there with say absolutely for sure on this site and only this site, I did feel something. So it's really up to each one of us to go there and check it out. And that's why I include very detailed getting to directions to all of the 108 sacred places in the books, because I really feel that getting people out to these sites and experiencing them is really the best way that they can understand what they're all about.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned four key vortices in the United States. Are they all in the Arizona area, or are they all over the place?
Well, those four in the book are just in the Sedona region.
Okay.
I do, in my book, Sacred Places Europe, I outline several in Europe, and those are along these ley line tracks. And there's the St. Mary's line and the St. Michael's line. And the St. Michael's line is really probably the most important and famous ley line in the world, because it connects all of these shrines or temples or even grottos devoted to St. Michael the Archangel all across Europe, starting in Skellingmichael, Ireland, these islands off of southwestern Ireland, cutting through Cornwall, going into France, and then down to Italy and Greece, straight to the Holy Land of Israel. All along the way, a straight line with a dozen Michael shrines, grottos, and temples, churches along the way. It's really quite fascinating, and it leads me to believe there it's more than just coincidence that this would happen.
On the vortices in Sedona, are they all lined up on you say they're on a ley line or some kind of energy line that has been noted by somebody, or did you just find it yourself?
No, they're very well established. They're in all the tourist pamphlets that you could pick up. They're not necessarily on a line per se. They're kind of scattered somewhat randomly. But they do all emanate the same kind of energy, this vortex, this swirling energy, this mind and body enhancement kind of energy. There's two kinds that can be experienced. There's the yin lines and the yang lines. And these happen to be the yin lines that are more curvaceous, just as we would imagine a woman identifying with the yin energy. It's when the straight lines intersect that they can be somewhat disruptive and cause people anxiety or anguish, sometimes has been reported. And those are the lines that don't always resonate with people. So these ones happen to have this more soothing kind of energy feeling that you get from it, feeling of well-being. And that's why they're so popular. I really just apart from going to them myself and trying to experience it, but not feeling it personally, I'll be honest with you, to just report on what other people were saying has happened there. And it's a big industry in Sedona to go visit these places, and people pay a lot of money to go down there and check them out. So I think there might be something to it.
And what are the claims of some of these places? Like, I do know there's occasional areas that are considered healing locations. Somebody can heal emotional problems and heal physical issues. And that leads us to considering spiritual levels, too. But have more vibrational strength for emotions, or are they broken down like that when people go out to these places, or what would you say about that?
Yeah, right. Well, that is what people will report, is that they will feel enhanced in certain ways. So if they had something on their minds, they're trying to work out a problem, might help them get through it. If they're dealing with a health issue, might help give them some insight how to deal with that, or even make them feel better. But what's interesting how it relates to sacred places, and by the way, there are no developments on these four vortex sites in Sedona. They're just natural, beautiful natural settings. Some you have to hike about an hour to get up to. But the ones in Europe often have a shrine or a holy well, or what was a pagan temple but is now a cathedral that had been a church. So it's really interesting that there is an evolution of how people have identified a place on the landscape, considered it sacred, and then built upon that site, often very primitive, like a wattle church that became one of the great cathedrals of Europe. And it's still on that exact same place. A good example is Chartres Cathedral outside of Paris, which began as a pagan shrine. And there may be a well down beneath the Chartres Cathedral that's still there. There's certainly some catacombs down there you're not allowed to go visit. But it's very interesting that it would be chosen on the very same site. It's not like they could have left the old one there and then just built a couple blocks away. It had to be on that site. So this, to me, lends to the credibility that there is such a thing called the power of place, that it's the location, 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 as they say in real estate, that is so vitally important to making these sites so potent to the human visitor.
Interesting. let's move on to New Mexico and the Chaco Canyon, which is a sacred place. But where is there? There's a number of ruins there, but is there any special location that you suggest in the book that is a real place to go?
Oh, Cliff, I'm glad you brought up Chaco Canyon. It has to be one of my favorite in North America. My experience when I went there, I camped out for a couple nights, and I just had the most vivid dreams every night. I feel like I was being visited in my dreams by the ancestors of this location. I'm not kidding. It was just so intense. And then each day I went out and explored a new location. So Chaco Canyon, if you can imagine, the capital of many outlier great houses is what they call them, and they're basically tenement style adobe tall buildings, sometimes three or four stories tall, where hundreds of people would live communally in these great houses. And radiating from Chaco Canyon were these straight roads that can still be discerned if flying over and the light is right. You can still make them out. And you can see from Chaco Canyon, which is in a canyon somewhat similar to Canyon de Chelly, but not so deep, are the stairways that lead out of the canyon that go to these great roads that lead to these outlier great houses of the Anasazi people. And in Chaco Canyon itself, you have several of these ruins of these great houses, these adobe tenement-style buildings. But also you have the kivas, and the kivas are round ceremonial centers that were originally covered over, so they're pitch black, except for a few very strategic windows. And inside the largest kiva at Chaco Canyon, there is a window that will open to the summer solstice light. So if you can imagine a ceremony taking place and nearly in pitch black conditions, and it happens to be on the solstice, and they lift the veil over one of these windows, and the light shining directly through that window and illuminating either sacred objects or carvings on the wall, it would be a very impressive sight to behold. Also found in Chaco Canyon is way up high on a mesa. They found these carvings that were very enigmatic. Nobody really knew what they were. They were kind of swirling designs and lines and some dots. Well, some archaeoastronomers, and that is those scientists who study archaeological sites for sightings and alignments, found that indeed these spirals would only illuminate during the solstice. And this is a very inaccessible location high up on a mesa. And the rocks would also act as shadows to indicate exactly what time of year it was. So they were using this as a sort of calendar, so they would know when to plant their seeds, when to harvest, maybe even when to migrate during the summer months to go hunting. So it shows, the big picture here is it shows that the Native American people, most especially those of the mound builder civilizations and those in the Southwest, were very sophisticated people that we haven't really given them as much credit as they deserve.
Mm-hmm. Does there appear to be some influence by Central American cultures, Mayan, Aztec, any of the other groups that were down there?
Well, sure, because Chaco Canyon is not too far away from Wipatki, maybe just a day or two walking, and the whole area was influenced. This, again, was Anasazi, which is not so much of a PC term anymore, because it means ancient enemy. And they're basically the Hopi people, because the Hopi have been there for a long, long time. But the the Navajo came down at a more recent period and were at war with the Hopi. So Anasazi means ancient enemy. Well, the Hopi took offense to that, and rightly so. So the more appropriate name now is the ancient people, or the ancient Hopi, the prehistoric Hopi people, were the creators of many of these landscapes in the Southwest, including Chaco Canyon. They had abandoned it, though, and that's what's so strange about many of these locations. As successful as it appeared they had become, by the time the Spanish had got there in the 15th, 16th century, they just found many of these cities completely abandoned, including many of their pots and sometimes even resources still intact, but no piles of dead bodies. It just appears that they may have had a drought or some kind of hardship and just had to up and leave and go to more fertile pastures.
I ask about the influence of Central America because I've reported, and a number of authors have reported, evidence of Maya, Aztec, and other people in the Mississippi area, and also some of the plains area. Some of the mound builders have found the evidence of sculptures and artifacts that are very similar to Maya. And I bring it up also because in your book you mentioned Aztec ruins, and I don't know if that's just an area or is it there actual evidence of Aztec ruins in the Chaco Canyon area?
Well, there were very similar artifacts found, I think, that could be used to connect the two. And again, the Aztec Empire, even the traditional boundaries stretched pretty much right up to the modern U.S.-Mexico border. So it's not too hard to imagine that they would just take another few days or a week to walk up to northern Arizona and northern New Mexico, even all the way up to Colorado and the Four Corners region. This is all part of the Anasazi homeland. I think the bigger mystery, and what still has not been accepted by modern archaeology, is the Mayan-Aztec connection to the mound builder and, as you said, the Mississippian culture of the Mississippi Valley and the plains.
Mm-hmm.
There is one location way up in Wisconsin, southern Wisconsin, called Aztalan. Now, that was misnamed because Aztalan was the homeland of the Aztec. But it was the fancy of an archaeologist who got into the location in the 19th century and called it that. But it's certainly a mound culture site that used a stockade wall that's been recreated up there. My uncle has a summer home not too far away, so I take my cousins up there, friends, we want to do a little road trip and show them some ancient culture. And again, that's what's so fascinating about these locations in North America. They're so accessible, and they're so rich in history that I highly recommend people go there and travel and see them for themselves.
Is there... Let me ask you about that. I mean, I haven't traveled enough. I want to go. I mean, I've visited the main cities in Arizona, Tempe and Phoenix, but these places are outside of those areas. From your perspective, why is it important to go to these places? I mean, other than to get out in nature, that's one big plus. But why would you suggest people go to these places?
In North America, many of us are removed from our origin of culture or our lineage, our heritage. Many of us are European Americans, and we're far, far away from European countries that our ancestors were from. So Americans are kind of lost in a way. We're lost that we don't have that connection to where our people came from. So when our European ancestors did come over here, they found a new connection. They started the culture from the old country in the new world. They developed their own pilgrimage sites that became significant. And as much as the Indians got the short end of the stick as far as manifest destiny and people coming here and basically stealing their land and making these sites seem unimportant, we've come full circle, and now we've come back to a period of longing for who we are, and not only for who we are, but who the Native American people were and what they found significant in their natural world. And so much of that has just been bulldozed over with development that it's very hard to see. You're on the East Bay in El Sobrante. I'm over here in San Francisco. All around the Bay Area here were these great shell mound sites, and they've all been destroyed. You can't really even go see them. They were several stories high from the shells that had been discarded, and many times they were also burial sites or artifacts have been found. The closest you can get is in Emeryville. You can go to Shell Mound Road and Ohlone Way, but it's a strip mall now. They took down the shell mound a long time ago to pave the way for development. So that's why it's important not only to protect these sites, but what's remaining of them, but for people to understand that this is part of the heritage of North America, this land that our ancestors came to and now that we're an integral part of. And it may be that you and I aren't Native American, Cliff, but we can still appreciate what the Native American people saw in these locations and maybe even find a moment ourselves to reflect and meditate and listen to what your mind says and learn something about ourselves when we go to these places.
Hmm. So it's kind of a connection to humankind is what you're saying, kind of a connection to why we're human, and these are places that is part of Earth, and there's a sacredness that you're appreciating in these places that you've listed in this book is basically what you're saying.
That's correct. And I'm in my apartment right now. You're inside. We're talking on a telephone. We're looking out the window and looking at buildings. Well, this has all been built by humans. Think about when the land was just the landscape, when there was no development, when people were migrating with the seasons, and they could look out at the landscape so much easier and identify what locations were significant to them. So that's why we need to respect and protect these sites, because the few that are remaining, and I'll use the example of the mound sites, there's only about 10% of them left. Could you imagine when the landscape was just filled with these, as well as similar to the Anasazi down in Chaco Canyon, the Hopewell culture built these great roads that oftentimes had berms that followed them, great rims that when the colonials found them, they would travel down there. They couldn't believe that the Native Americans would be so sophisticated to have built these great rings and mound sites and roads. And they had to dismiss them because the Native Americans were just the noble savages that we had every right to wipe out in our quest to conquer this continent. So the ones that have remained, they're significant, they're important, and they're still very powerful, in my opinion.
Fascinating. I want to get to the Plains area. I want to touch Canada and then get to the South. But before we do that, you bring up an area that I have not visited, which is Blythe, California, and the giant glyphs that are carved into the ground that can only be seen by a plane flying over them. Can you talk a little bit about those?
Sure. Well, yeah, very fascinating. And I have a Facebook page called Sacred Places 108 Destinations, and I just posted some glyphs that were discovered in Asia, others in Africa. Of course, there's the Nazca lines down in Peru, and there are these geoglyphs right along the Colorado River, both on the California and the Arizona side. The Blythe intaglios are the ones that I visited. And when you stand there, I didn't have the opportunity to fly over them. When you stand there, you can make out part of the figure, but you cannot see the entirety of it unless you're overhead, similar to those Nazca lines and others worldwide that I mentioned. So what makes these so significant is that they show humans and animals and geometric shapes, spirals, straight lines. They tell us a story, but what that story is, we're really not quite that sure. And this was a great example of how I rolled into the town of Blythe, went to a restaurant and asked the waitress if she's ever been out there, if she could tell me anything about it. Oh, I heard about them. I drive by the marker every time, but I never stopped to see them.
That's fascinating.
That was a place I went back to and said, oh, you got to go. And she's like, well, I guess this time I'll stop since you say they're so important and interesting.
Oh, God. I mean, it's weird that they would figure out how to make these figures. This one man who's, I don't know, he must be hundreds of feet long and his arms are open. I mean, how did they figure that out? It's just nobody knows. You only can see him from high up and above.
Well, I have to admit they're not perfectly anatomically correct. they're kind of more like stick figures, so I guess you could fudge it. Not to say that they're flying overhead and say, oh no, a little more to the right, a little more to the left. It's within the realm of believing that they just etched them out. But the significance of why these figures are even there and who they may represent, perhaps a shaman, and maybe this was a ritual site, maybe this was a really important place that they would try to convene with the Great Spirit.
Mm-hmm. And are there places of energy vortices and places where you sit in rocks and things like that, or is it more open ground and they're not quite sure why they would carve these massive glyphs?
Yeah, they're basically on the upper plain of the Colorado River, which probably was a very old floodplain, but very similar to the Nazca Line. They're in a very high, desert, dry place where it doesn't rain much. So basically, it's called the patina of the rock. It basically gets black from the sun, and I think there's some kind of fungus that may grow that makes the one side of the rock turn black. So when you scrape it, when you scrape the surface, you can make a discernible line of the brown earth. So that's what shows both here and in Nazca. And unfortunately, in both locations, people have driven across them with ATVs and four-wheel drive and tore up the landscape. So you also see a lot of tire tracks going through. Fortunately for Blythe and for Nazca, they've protected these sites and put fences around them so people can't vandalize them. But similar to the medicine wheels in Canada and Northern Plains, people have vandalized them and pulled rocks away, and the medicine wheels themselves are slowly disappearing because souvenir hunters want to keep a rock, but you can't do that.
Exactly. You mentioned Canada. Let's go up to Canada for a minute. Can you give us, say, two or possibly three locations you found particularly outstanding as sacred sites?
Sure. Well, I just mentioned the medicine wheels. For sure, the medicine wheels are very significant locations, and they're most of the medicine wheels of North America are in Canada. About two-thirds of all the medicine wheels are up there in the Great White North, and they do extend quite far north into Canada on the plains of Alberta and Saskatchewan. We went and visited one on an army base. We had to get escorted across a testing ground, and it was only on a day that they weren't having any exercises. That was called Moose Mountain, really fascinating one. There's Majorville Medicine Wheel just across the border from Glacier National Park. But probably the most famous one is Bighorn Medicine Wheel, which is actually in Wyoming. You were interested in Canada, and I'll tell you some locations that are very significant. One is called Sprout Lake in BC, Canada, and it has these petroglyphs, one of which appears to be a sea monster. And this is what the Native American people believe, that there was like a Loch Ness-type monster in this lake. Don't think there's been any reputable sightings of anything like that. Hmm. But the legend remains, and the petroglyph remains, and people can go up to see it. Similarly, on the shore of Lake Superior on the Canada side, there are some significant pictographs. And the difference between the two is pictographs are actually paintings. Picto meaning a picture and graph meaning painting or material, where petroglyph is actually chipped away or carved out of the rock itself. And Agawa Bay, Canada, is a pictograph of another sea monster. And this one is very interesting because it's shown escorting a canoe full of Native Americans across Lake Superior. And
wow.
As we all know from the famous Gordon Lightfoot song, I think that was who it was that did the song about the ship that sunk in Lake Superior, the Edmund Fitzgerald, that Lake Superior can become very stormy and very dangerous. And just like the founder of North Face and Patagonia clothes tipped over in a kayak last week and died, you could freeze to death from hypothermia in a matter of minutes. So it's interesting that the sea monster, which many of us would think would attack humans or be an enemy, turned out to be benevolent and was the guide to get them across the lake during stormy times.
Interesting.
And then I really like, I'll add a fourth to your list of three. I really like this a pilgrimage site called Saint-Anne de Beporie in Quebec, just outside of Quebec City. In fact, the pilgrimage location would begin in Quebec City. And all along the way, you can still see ovens to cook bread for the pilgrims who would walk, sometimes even on their hands and knees. This doesn't really happen much anymore, but in the time of the colonials in New France, which was what Quebec was, this was a site of deliverance because all of the founders of New France, of course, came over by boat. And many times they would have hardships, ships sinking or capsizing, and again, fighting hypothermia to swim to shore. And indeed, that is how Saint-Anne de Beporie started, was some shipwrecked sailors prayed to the mother of the grandmother of Jesus Christ, and they were saved, and they built this great cathedral there, and for hundreds of years has been a very significant pilgrimage location in New France. We often think pilgrimage locations happen in Europe or in India, some of these older locations, but we have them here in North America as well.
You mentioned medicine wheels, and I want to talk about this one that you feature prominently in the book. It's in Wyoming. It's called Bighorn Medicine Wheel. You mentioned it. What? It looks huge. It looks massive. And is there an age for this medicine wheel? I've never seen one this big before.
Well, it's really hard to date medicine wheels because they're made out of stacked stones. Of course, you can't radiocarbon date the age of stone or when somebody placed them there. But they're very old, and they know this because some of the stones also show this patina, this coloration from being in one location for a long time. What's so significant about the medicine wheels and the one Bighorn medicine wheel is that for a long time nobody thought they really meant or represented anything. But again, archaeoastronomy is a very new science. Only in the 1960s did it start coming up with some results that were very fascinating, including those at Bighorn Medicine Wheel. And indeed, they showed that the medicine wheel indicates the rising of the summer solstice sun. I went out there on the summer solstice to see it for myself. We got there at night, 3 in the morning, found the place and just kind of took a cat nap. And I have a photo in Sacred Place in North America in the color photo section of the sunrise coming right up over the alignment. So I can tell you indeed, these are indications. And then there was another spokes into this Carn mound, stacked stone mound of the sunset. So it would be very important to know these kind of things, especially for the migratory Plains Indians, because if you didn't know when it was a good time to get out of there from hunting buffalo, you might get socked in by a snowstorm and then real hardships would occur. So to have this information of the shaman class to pass on to the people would be hugely significant. It would probably be a matter of life and death to know these kind of things. So that's why I say that the sophistication level of Native American people, even those transitory types who just followed the buffalo and had their summer dwellings down in what is today Kansas and the southern plains states, would travel all the way up north to Canada hunting buffalo. They would have to know when to get out of there before the winter storms came.
Interesting. What is tell us what a medicine wheel is. What defines a medicine wheel?
Well, that I guess it's more of a modern term. Medicine, as used by Native American, it just is another way of saying sacred, because medicine to them was the plants. The Great Spirit would guide them in times of sickness. It wasn't always about getting cured of something, but to having a vision quest, say, or to going to these locations and convening with nature, because these medicine wheels not only would show the rising and setting of the solstice sun, which is significant, but also the stars, the prominent stars in the summer night sky. Vega, I know, is one, and several others that shone bright, and the medicine wheels would point to them. What's so very interesting about Bighorn Medicine Wheel is it's way up on the shoulder of Medicine Mountain in Wyoming, almost 10,000 feet up. So half of the year, this medicine wheel is covered in snow and completely useless. So yeah. These things were used in the summer months because that's when people could go up there, and most probably the holy men of the tribes that used and built them to determine the dates of the season and probably pray and have ceremonies to the great spirits. What's so cool about them today is that Native Americans still go up there and still have ceremonies and put up prayer flags, and you can tell that they're very important to the Native American people of the region still.
Mm-hmm. And is that one of those areas that is sacred, where meditations can take place and people can kind of sit and commune with nature?
Oh, absolutely. Once again, it's an extraordinarily beautiful natural setting. Mm-hmm. So to look out over the mountains and be up on this shoulder of a mountain, and here's this native sacred place that's very old, mm-hmm. it's just a feeling that you have to go there and experience yourself.
Amazing. God, there's so many places in this book. It's amazing. We don't have time for all 108, but let's travel to a couple more places. Oklahoma, you mentioned Spiro Mounds, and you do cover mounds quite a bit in the book, and we've talked about previous programs about the Serpent Mounds, there's Mississippi Mounds that are very energetic in terms of unseen fields that come up and pulse through. And I've heard a number of people say that when you're close to the Serpent Mound, that you can actually feel a charge coming out of it, depending on where you're sitting. Tell us about Spiro Mound. The Spiro Mounds of Oklahoma. What's unique about those areas?
Sure. Well, Spiro is so amazing because in the largest mound, there was some excavations that occurred in the 1930s. Unfortunately, they weren't done by professionals, but more by treasure seekers who were looking to find things. And they pulled out a huge treasure trove of artifacts and just sold them on the roadside. So many of them were just lost for profit seekers during the Great Depression. And many of these places had no protection, so people could do that. Just show up with a shovel and start digging, see what you find.
Wow.
Well, what's so fascinating about Spiro is in the largest mound, they found an enclosed tomb. And there was a man wearing a suit of armor, not the kind of suit of armor you'd think of from medieval times, but more like a Native American armament. But this guy appeared to be a European, and he was much bigger than Native Americans, and he had some instruments with him that appeared to be European. Well, what's so interesting about Spiro is its location. It's very close to a place called Hevener. And Hevener is a hill where these rune stones have been found. There had been several that were scattered around the Hevener area. Only one remains today, and I went and visited it and photographed it. There's a picture of it in the book that looks like it was delineated for land, that it was saying this is where so-and-so lives and keep out, kind of as we do with our signs today. So it would tie into Spiro that this was an area that had been discovered by the Vikings as they were making deep incursions into North America. and I include several Viking sites in sacred places in North America because they're extremely significant and a bit of untold history. Those being, the others being the Kensington Rune Stone up in Minnesota, as well as the Newport Tower in Rhode Island that has some inscriptions that appear to be runic in nature. So the whole saga of the Vikings making their way deep into North America, including those furnace mounds at a place called Spruce Grove in Ohio, where they found telltale signs that somebody was smelting metal to create bronze and brass. And you can only do that with the sophisticated knowledge of creating a very hot fire and putting in copper and then mixing it with tin or iron to create other substances. Now, what's so very important about this is that no Native American culture was ever known to have learned the art of smelting. Yet here we have very ancient ovens in Ohio. We have artifacts that were clearly made from combining two metals to create a stronger metal. That was the whole point of it. Mm-hmm. And these stodgy historians just won't acknowledge it. And I think that's so incredibly wrong because they're even in museums. You can go to museums in Ohio and see artifacts of brass and bronze, as well as those that were found with some of these skeletons, most namely in also Fall River, Massachusetts, not far at all from Newport, Rhode Island, is the famous Skeleton in Armor, which was a poem written by the famous 19th century poet Longfellow. Hmm. And it describes this very tall European wearing these brass armor plates. And I guess not surprisingly, because this doesn't fit with the cookie cutter model of history that we've been spoon-fed all these years, that skeleton armor was destroyed. Yeah, it was destroyed in a fire, which was arson. So some people didn't want this story to be told. But I'm telling it, and it's real. They were all over the continent.
It's funny you mentioned that. We've had numerous authors who've actually written about the unknown history of ancient America, that there is a pre-Indian, pre-Native culture influence, European, in some cases, Viking, even Celtic and Roman coins have been found. So when you talk like this, it's fun because you don't really mention it in the book, but this is something that you have discovered on your own that hasn't been reported by academic science because it just throws a wrench into their understanding or their history. So fascinating.
Yeah, and then when you also factor in the prehistoric stone chambers of New England, and I call them prehistoric because I think that's what they are, they were dismissed by many historians as colonial root cellars or sweat lodges for Native Americans. Native Americans said, we had nothing to do with them. They've been there all this time. And the fact that you have to stoop very low to go through an enclosed entranceway to get into many of these beehive-shaped structures pretty much rules out the root cellar. Why would you make the entrance so difficult that you can't even get a wheelbarrow through there and you'd break your back if you're carrying anything heavy? So these are really fascinating artifacts. And as I said on the top of the show, they incorporate the cultural diffusion model of history, and that is people have been crossing the oceans, spanning the continents, interacting with cultures, sharing information and even technology in the form of these furnaces and implements, that the true history of North America is going to have to incorporate visitors that came from all over the place, including China on the West Coast, including the Phoenicians who made their way all the way up through the Great Lakes to collect the copper. The largest resource of copper on the planet is in the Lake Superior region. And I had the great opportunity of being on the History Channel show called America Unearthed with Scott Walter.
Yes.
And the show we did was about the Waubonsie Stone in Chicago, and that's where I grew up. The oldest artifact in Chicago is this enigmatic face with a bowl cavity on top, and it flowed out through the mouth. And then the mouth were pursed lips, and presumably the fluid that came from the bowl on the top down through the mouth dripped into another catch basin, which was like a goatee beard. Well, Native American people didn't have facial hair. They did have any. They plucked it out. They certainly didn't glamorize it wearing goatee beards like the Phoenicians did. And this was the conclusion I came to in Sacred Places North America when I highlighted the Waubonsie Stone, and also what Scott Walter and Wayne May of Ancient American Magazine also believe.
Fantastic.
Yeah, they came down here to collect the copper, and when they had a heavily laden boat, they couldn't go back via the Great Lakes because of the Niagara Falls. There was no way to get over the Niagara Escarpment. But the way out is the way the Native American people showed Father Marquette and Louis Joliet, the first French trappers and explorers in the Great Lakes region, and that is why the city of Chicago is where it is, because that is the water route to get from the Great Lakes. You go basically through the Chicago River, South Branch, to a place called Mud Lake in what is now Lyons, Illinois, a suburb of Chicago, and this is where I filled my segment with Scott on America on Earth. And it's from that location, especially after a heavy rain year in the spring, that you could get a heavily laden boat filled with copper from the South Branch through Mud Lake to the Des Plaines River, from the Des Plaines River down to the Illinois River, Illinois River to the Mississippi, out to the Gulf of Mexico.
Fascinating.
So this is a very ancient trade route, and it was very well known to the Native American people, and they showed it to the first French explorers.
Yeah, we've had Scott on the program. He's very passionate about the Templar Knights and their passages and their being here in the North American area. So it's a fascinating subject. Brad Olson, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure. The book's called Sacred Places North America 108. You can get it on Amazon. It's both hardback and digital. And I think what you're in your second version or a revision on this, Brad, what is the – it's been out for a little bit now. So you've updated.
The second edition is second edition. What's available now. You could also go to cccpublishing.com. That's our publishing website. And if you order books off of CCC Publishing, they go through my office, so I'm able to sign copies for people. That's the only way. And we also have a DVD out on the prehistoric stone chambers of New England that's available on that website as well. Or if you want to learn more about me, it's bradolson.com. Olsen is the way I spell my last name. Bradolson, one word, .com.
Fantastic. Hey, appreciate your time. Fantastic subject. It's really got me thinking about getting out. Good way to take a short vacation, go drive to Arizona or New Mexico, and on the way, check out some of these places.
Well, thanks for having me on, Cliff. It was great talking to you, and maybe we should do it again sometime.
We definitely will. Thanks for your time. So that's our program today, and I want to remind everybody that our guest next week is Randall Carlson, who is featured pretty prominently on Graham Hancock's new book, Magicians of the Gods. And he is going to talk to us about a lot of new research that he's come up with on the catastrophic events known as the Younger Dryas period in Earth's history, which basically wiped the planet clean of most, if not all, civilizations and forced humanity to restart itself. So that's next week on Earth Ancients. Hope you have a great day.